Dissolution by Stefan Molyneux, freedomain.com/donate. Chapter 7. Robert and his father John were too similar to get along. Fathers and sons can get along if they share universal values, but status is not a universal value because it is win-lose, like two pieces of paper being pushed together on a tabletop. One has to slide over the other. John wanted to be a father because it was expected and it would be shameful to appear infertile. People who choose to live without having children are considered oddballs, shallow, selfish. You have to network, and networking means bragging about your children. Subtly, of course, with all due humility and the self-erasing language of they did it all themselves. This way, you can brag about genes, which cannot be replicated or surmounted. John was a calculator, a workhorse, a lofty machine spitting out numbers and intimidation. His wife, Jean, had once complained about John's endless complaints about his bosses, and he went in the next morning and quit in a cold rage at his bosses, his life, and his wife, and shocked her by announcing that he was starting his own company immediately. These kinds of shocks reverberated through John's family on a regular basis. Jean's brother once, half-jokingly, referred to John as a money nerd, and John never initiated conversation with him ever again. "I won't be rude," was the best concession Jean could wring out of him. Because Jean's family never talked about anything of substance, emotion, or meaning, this rift could never be healed. John referred to them as emotional hemophiliacs, because no cut, wound, or scrape could ever be healed. The family structure was a house of cards welded together with iron avoidance. People were angry but joked, were sad but danced anyway, were lonely but endlessly got together, genuinely smiled in pictures while plotting a vengeance that everyone knew would never come. Children were a form of performance art, encouraged but not mentored, praised but not tutored, trained but not empathized with, servants of vanity and status, flashy mirrors of empty egos and goose steppers in a mirrored parade of ticker tape and bright-eyed servitude. John started his company, shamelessly stole customers from his former employers, and took out a second mortgage to fund his very expensive offices. He was threatened with lawsuits for poaching, but he had such a perfect frozen face of rage and cruelty that people flinched and blinked at the idea of taking him on in court. They feared the kinds of lawyers he would hire, the kinds of countersuits he would file, and the vicious rumors he would spread. Like a shark in the ocean, frictionless hunting was his element. Once, when legal action was threatened over lunch, John replied, "Hey, would you rather face a big dog on land, like a rabid husky or a pit bull, or a tiny 2-foot shark in the deep ocean?" His aggressor had been bewildered. "What?" John had picked at his white teeth with a toothpick, stretching back his cheeks, so his molars were visible. "Most people choose the shark." "That's stupid. That will get you killed. With the dog, you can climb a tree, get to safety, throw a rock, hit it with a stick. Even if it gets on you, you can gouge an eye." He laughed. "Both of you are lucky. You're both in your element, right? On land, used to gravity and momentum." John leaned forward. "But in the ocean, you're in the shark's world, right? What are you going to do? It can just circle you and be patient. One little chomp every half hour, every hour, then you're bleeding. Even if more sharks don't come, you can't really fight it. It can come up from below. And when it bites, you get weaker and the shark gets stronger. You got to use your arms to stay afloat. There's no trees to climb, no rocks to throw, just bleeding and waiting and panicking. John leaned further forward. You just have to think about it, right? The lunch ended abruptly. No legal action ensued. John let out his feral side, only occasionally, but with such intensity and always without apology, that it could never be forgotten. John had once eaten a bad banana and had avoided them for the next 5 years. He had resolutely refused to bike on roads after the narrow wheel of his 10-speed got lodged in a sewage grate. This was before they all got replaced with diagonal slots. The battles between Robert and his father were the stuff of family legend. John was always demanding that his sons take advanced adult courses in night school. Robert took a course in computer architecture, but spent the night classes programming a space game in the language BASIC, no less, which meant it was crushingly slow. And he was rebuked by the teacher for playing a game, even though he stopped playing in order to show the source code. John bragged about this for months. My son is doing adult computer classes. Until Robert finally told him that he never finished it. He just went to the mall across the street and dropped off and wandered around. But John was strangely zen about it all. Bragging rights had been achieved, after all, and it wasn't as if anyone he had told about Robert's course would demand a transcript for proof. Doubt and skepticism were so lower class. John attracted employees by endlessly talking about excellence and dedication and commitment. And he paid well on an annualized basis. But woe to any employee who calculated his or her hourly rate after all the endless overtime was factored in. John lured employees into working 50 to 70 hours a week by creating an abstract and largely imaginary, to be honest, time bank, wherein overtime stacked up and could be traded in for days off. This appeasement technique was wildly impractical. The workload was so intense that days off for, say, hernia surgery were grudging and theoretical, since inter-office emails and even calls would pile up that night and into the next day. To his credit, John never referred to his company as a family, but that was because even his most idealistic employees would have laughed at the idea. John was so focused, so intense, so supernaturally wedded to the cult of excellence, that the type of Fezziwig bonus benevolence that family companies manifested would have been ridiculously incomprehensible. John was all about the job. The job was the local cult deity, the stone Aztec altar where youth, fertility, eyesight, and relationships were all sacrificed under the iron knives of professional intensity. In former eras, John would have been a slit-helmeted warlord, charging from the semi-brave middle of his horse-thundering army, screaming at rusty blades and faltering hearts. Split on the knife edge of life or death, victory or enslavement, conquest or a cut throat. If the job was dodging spears and beheading the hesitant, John would have been perfect. He came from the same stock that ensured that the sun never set on the British Empire. Able to sharpen souls with stirring words and wring murder out of even the most gentle with the passion of his bladed tongue. Alas, the age of conquest was past, and men like John were shuffled into the realms of narrow-eyed exhortations under fluorescent lights, whipping the inexperienced into frenzied attacks on evasive numbers, endlessly updated regulations, and overcomplicated spreadsheets. Tax season was the peak of his annual battle. And he savaged the unprofessional for wanting sleep and hobbies and maybe a few scraps of love. He turned accounting into a war with competitors. Laziness, the demands of sleep and sex and friendship, all had to be sacrificed for the sake of the job. John made very good money, which he dutifully turned over to his wife to spend on all the useless bric-a-brac that makes up 90% of the modern economy. On the rare occasions that Jean could wrangle him into a mall, John would wander like Genghis Khan at a yoga retreat, shocked and appalled at all the useless and ridiculous crap that women stuffed into their homes. Like magpies with soda can tabs, he thought, as his wife asked him to rate 3 different lamps at the Bombay Company. John would think back on his student days when he slept on a broken futon and woke up one morning with a pigeon on his chest. He collected coupons and froze submarine sandwiches to eat later, always forgetting to defrost them in time and having to crunch his way through the frigid mess as he ran to class. Was he happier now or then? John was self-aware enough just to understand the dangers of nostalgia. But the plain fact is that he was happier back then. Life was simpler. He didn't have to endlessly juggle other people's needs and wants and mindlessly nod at their incomprehensible desires. I was happier then. But I would not be happy if I was still there. That was the general curse of later middle age. When John was 25, he was doing a postgraduate degree in accounting, and he got his own permanent desk at the library, right by an impossibly tall window that faced a lush Toronto park. He would read his books and take his notes in a giant couch warmed in a soft summer haze until he drifted off to gentle and pleasant naps. He had no car, not even a transit pass. He just biked everywhere, summer or winter, spending almost nothing and needing even less. He was a monk of numbers and deferred ambition. John did not study to get rich, but to be practical. He once came across an article about a man who had fought in the Second World War, who said that his war years were the best years of his life. It was incomprehensible to John in a way, but from another angle, he deeply understood it. He felt a sudden rage one evening picking up yet more two-for-one sub sandwiches when the James Brown song, "This Is a Man's World," came on the tinny speakers. "Bull," he muttered, suddenly aware of how far the world had strayed from his ancestors. The ancient world of farming, of hunting and singing, and taking days off to kneel and contemplate life and love and the eternal mysteries. How trampled by high-heeled pumps that world now was. The world was run by red tape and caution and rules and con-goddamn consideration. Sensitivity and empathy and caressing and protecting feelings. That was the estrogen quicksand of the modern world. And he felt a deep testicular revulsion at the streets and the stores and the crazy people that women had clamored to be let out of asylums, and all the women with debt-laden fake degrees being well-subsidized to consume garbage and never produce babies. John walked past the stores across the grimy pavement with its pink flatware of age-old bubblegum, and he looked at the shops, at who they served, and what they sold. He walked past the museum, past the prom dress vanity boutiques and Italian coffee bars and dessert cafes and flower shops. And it was all so girly. And he vowed to walk until he found a store for men, just for men, not fashion shops selling what women liked to see men wearing, but something for men alone. And there was nothing. Nothing at all. The world of men is dead. We live in a soft, claustrophobic womb now. His own father, back from the war, handed over his paycheck and drank softly, steadily. His mother spent and nagged, driving his father deeper into drink and John out into the world the moment he could. After the cursed grade 13, he skipped home and town for a year of manual labor and recovery from the estrogen overdoses that shape modern manhood into blind surrender or rebellion. Nothing so extreme can provoke anything in between. And he vowed to make a world for men, for excellence and dedication and commitment and the serious evisceration of anything sensitive and feminine and over-solicitous. So the night that Jean complained about him complaining, John remembered his vow. Hard to recall, since the world is always designed to distract us from integrity, and thought, complaining is feminine. And he quit the next day. And never explained or complained ever again. John required this of his sons as well. He lectured them on the foolishness of complaining. Said it was the job of women to complain and men to shut up and make things right. Complaints come out of the stupid theory that life is supposed to be fair. Fair is just a weak word used by idiots to claim something they didn't earn. Never complain, boys. You want something, go out and get it. Make it. Make it yourself or make the case why it should happen. My company's accountant, yeah, dentists need dentists. Once some computerized system upgrade nags me, reminds me, sends me brochures, and I keep telling him the same damn thing. You want me to buy it? Make the case. But he's a single son of a single mother, useless for that kind of stuff. His mother just complained and got stuff. He doesn't have a clue how to make a robust case, a male case. I'm unhappy. Fix my problems. John shuddered. Ugh. But he's a wizard with numbers, knows the law, and doesn't know his own worth, so he's gold to me. He wants me to give him money, and I keep telling him, give me money and we'll talk. How much time and money will this software upgrade save me? It costs $20,000 plus $3,000 a year in support. How does that put money in my pocket? Is it going to save me $10,000 a year? So it pays for itself in just under 3 years. Don't forget the support cost, boys. So then he's putting money in my pocket, $7,000 a year going forward. John held up a warning finger. But when does it need another upgrade? 5 years, another $20,000? Not worth it. But he wants it, so he nags for it. John laughed harshly. Not to me anymore, but to others. Tries to get me encircled. Manipulative. The word man shouldn't even be in that word, let alone at the start. Womanipulative more like. Don't ever be like that, boys. Earn it or forgo it. There's nothing else. The pattern of sons, the eldest the conformist, the younger the rebel, held true in John and Jean's household. John's prickly nature, excess masculinity perhaps, provoked excess femininity on his wife's part. She railed against his dominance, but needed his dominance too much to effectively undermine it. She loved the mansion, the infinite credit cards, the country club and vacations. She learned to live without much love, but this left her disaffected, discontented. She could not show any of this, of course. since that would have torpedoed her battleship of infinite status, so all her friends thought she was blessed with affection, rather than cursed with alienating social altitude. Mothers starved of affection always target a vulnerable child. They hold on to the childhood of that offspring far too long, trapping him, in this case, in limitless language, twirling their hair and spilling secrets and thoughts and impressions like endless amber rolling over a paralyzed insect. Any movement of the boy, of Shane, to escape the descending nets of his mother's rambling provoked instant impatience and aggression. Once in Boy Scouts, his tent softly collapsed and folded over him, releasing all the rainwater and almost suffocating him, and he leapt awake from a dream of his mother that perfectly embodied her garrulous exploitations. And so Jean sat between Shane and the escape door in a sunroom, in the movie theater room, and even, if she felt particularly needy, in his own room. She would bring him some milk in the morning and then milk him dry with snared listening. He would gulp his milk and want more, but Jean would ignore him, and the white-rimmed glass would hang in his hand until he retreated into the corner of the wall, piling up his blankets in a futile, imaginary wall of defense. "So your father has seen fit to book a spa day for me, Shady. And I know it's not for me, not by a long shot. And it's just because it's a holiday weekend and he can't do 3 days with me in a row. It's the executive package, which is rich because nobody can do 4 hours at a spa on a Monday if they're an executive. And he sits and grins at me like I'm an idiot, a child, and can't see exactly what he's up to. Sipping his coffee in that stained college mug that I thought of dropping about 1,000 times. For you, my dear, because you work so hard. It's not clearly sarcastic enough that I can respond, fight back, whatever, but it's a dig. I'm working hard on my business, but he doesn't care." Jean shuddered. "I look at the time when you and Rob are gone out in the world and it's just me and this house and that ghost, that money machine. I do love him, of course. He's given us the world, but it's like living with a lottery ticket." She laughed. "That's unfair, because a lottery ticket wouldn't keep me confined. Touchless. Sorry, that's not for you. How are things at school? How are your friends? Is there any girl that you like? I haven't noticed you drawing so much lately. Why is that? I know Rob is your father's shadow, but you're more like me. You yearn." Jean laughed again. "Like a Disney princess. I want. Men like your father run the world. They make everything. But we make everything worthwhile, you know? A house isn't a home without paintings on the wall. He builds the house. We hang the paintings. He'd live in a cave with a straw for a bed if it wasn't for people like us. But only the house seems to matter. That's all that is appreciated." Jean's face turned suddenly bitter, and Shane backed himself even more tightly into the corner, still holding his empty milk glass. "And he gets his appreciation, that's for sure. His income and customers and employees fawning all over him like a drill sergeant of dollars. His awards all on the wall, like a dozen of them, and only one picture of his family, me, in the background on his desk." She snapped her fingers. "That's what I'm worth. And I got him a lovely framed portrait from our wedding day and delivered it to his office, looking so pretty. And he just scowled and said he didn't want people to see how much he's aged. And he hasn't aged that badly, damn him. It's different for men, you'll see. You just slowly turn into these wooden natives, Indians. We just bloat and fold over and sag. You just harden, at least he does. We get wrinkles, you just get character lines. And I would be happier, believe it or not, if he showed at least some interest in something other than work. Not even money. He doesn't care as much about that. It's just stuff in my mouth and shut me up, I think, sometimes. Even if he flirted with other women. He could, you know. He had mad game, as you would say, when he was young. Not younger anymore, just young. We crossed that wrinkled Rubicon years ago. And so I get wrinkles, he just gets character creases. It's unfair. And she would go on and on for reasons that Shane could never understand. What was the point of all these words? What did they achieve? They flowed over him. He was an embedded pebble in a storm-swollen, leaf-laden stream. And he was trapped and helpless and airless under turning sticks and tumbling minnows and rippling storm clouds half a universe above. And when he was 10, Shane had to have a scalp cyst lanced, which was surprisingly pain-free, at least after the numbing injections around it. And he thought at once of his mother's endless rambling, inflicted only on him, which rhymed with his name, shame, and thought that it was that words somehow swelled and grew within her like an infection, and she had to release them before they overwhelmed her, like vomiting after food poisoning. Which meant that Shane was a kind of poison receptacle. When he was doing a river walk with a shy girl he liked, a frog jumped on her and she screamed and threw it away, and it landed on his head comically and peed down his neck. Shane had laughed, not wanting to alarm the girl, and released the frog. But he spent the rest of the walk down the churning river. He was catching crayfish. She stayed on the bank, railing against his inner mother. Words grew within her like tumors or infections, and she threw them at him, into him, rather than be bloated and destroyed by their endless multiplication. And Jean didn't need agreement or pushback or even acknowledgement, it seemed. She just needed trapped carbon dioxide in the vicinity. Her barbed exhalations of rambling language just needed other exhalations, slow, measured, cornered, to merge with and overwhelm. And so Shane was inevitably drawn to art. He was so traumatized by language that he could not write or sing or act. He got lost in his own imagination when trapped by his mother, so immobility and creativity merged within him. He drew mostly in defense to start with when he smelled his mother's afternoon decaf floating down the hall towards him. He would pull open a sketch pad and pencils, always ready like a chameleon's camouflage, and tell his mother that he was in the middle of drawing. About half the time, this would work. The decaf would pause before his door, almost sniffing like a predator, striving to determine whether the rabbit was too deep in its warren, then slowly recede, perhaps waiting for him to emerge. The other half of the time, the door would open, and the chilling words would enter, "You draw too much. Take a break." Jean was, apparently, an expert in every form of excess, except her own. And then Shane would be trapped, staring at his drawings of a sad old man lost in a maze of hedgerows. And he would hear his father and younger brother yelling at the hockey game downstairs, knowing that the predation upstairs was spattering the jugular optimism of his young soul all over the off-white walls, the ceiling even, and not caring at all. It was like ancient Christian conquistadors whistling and strolling past the bloody altars of bitter-mouthed Aztec priests, disassembling the chests of drugged children for the sake of their darkest deities. Shane resented that he was stuffed into the yawning maw of his mother's language. There was no compensation, no reward, no thanks. Here, take my wife, kid, so I can get some fun out of my scraps of free time. And so Shane was not given over to sports the way that Rob was. Shane was not encouraged to date. Shane was not driven to friends' houses for sleepovers and weekend hangouts. Shane had to be kept in the house. Like a little tow-haired fire extinguisher for the slow maternal word flames that always erupted but never consumed.
You appease the matriarch. We'll do the manly stuff.
It was hard not to become bitter at the ease at which Shane was sacrificed to maternal loneliness, or the fact that Jean's loneliness was to a large part generated by her selfishness in the pursuit of the pretense of conversation. How many lonely people are isolated by their selfishness? No one wants to be used as a lined bag receptacle for endless words, so the vicious circle is inevitable, endless. If Jean had shown more interest, any interest really, in others, they would have enjoyed her company. Desperate grabbing in a dangerous ocean does not result in an excess of rescue. Shane grew to feel that since he was sacrificed, he was owed. Justice required that he be paid. But to be paid, the debt had to be acknowledged, which did not seem about to happen at all. The dismal physics of dysfunction in families only operate if they are never named. And the whole family resisted Shane growing up and moving away, since that would unleash his mother's words on everyone else. He was the dam, the dike, the Van Allen belt, the shades in the face of the eternal eclipse, and he had to stay exactly where he was, so that the selfishness of everyone around him, his mother to talk, his brother and father to avoid his mother's talking, could continue. And the day, that day that changed everything, or revealed everything, it's always hard to tell, was the day that Shane asked for something and chickened out of everything. John had the cold-hearted practical man's disdain for creativity. Practicality is about control. Creativity is about relinquishing control. Practicality defines the goal and the steps to achieve it. Creativity unravels an impulse, a deeper intuited truth, and feels its way forward like an octopus exploring coral. Practicality is the ambition. Creativity is the dream. John always felt that creativity was the consolation prize for impractical souls. You can't actually build a bridge, but maybe you can paint a picture of the bridge that competent men actually put together. You can't have a dynamic, dominant, and heroic life, but perhaps you can scribble a story about imaginary heroes or sketch how their armor might have looked. The outlandish nerds into Star Trek, Star Wars, and comic books all worshipped heroes, yet with the farthest creatures from heroism that could be conceived of. Imaginary heroism was like a vampire to John. It sucked and drained and provided the feeling of courage, while strengthening the neurotic musculature of cowardice to Olympian levels. Pornography for the soulless. He had scorn for the scribbling, as he called it, and impatience and incomprehension and scorn. He viewed Shane as a loser, a dark room dwelling mole, as a failed beta for the successful launch of Robert. The circularity of this was lost on John, who viewed his own life and status as the ideal, and thus viewed all divergences of opinion or outcomes as woefully inferior, to be pitied and insulted, and even encouraged, perhaps, but never accepted as equal. Thus does an athlete who wins Olympic gold view all other athletes and their choices.
Not bad, but not gold either, bro.
This was why John won in business and why he lost with Shane. It is very hard for children to overcome the impressions their parents have of them. If your father considers you a loser, any kind of winning means breaking the bond and outgrowing his contempt. People who demand that you stay small to conform to their vanities, well, their expectations require that for them to be something, you have to be less, or nothing, ideally. John criticized his eldest son for cleaving too much to his mother, but never lifted a finger to rescue him from her. He scorned his son for his creativity and art, but never shouldered him into the practical realm of empirical achievements. To confront the underlying reasons for Shane's behavior, well, that was a self-sown landmine that would cost him far more than an arm and a leg. It was a very early morning when half of the truth came out, a dawn time of honesty before the distractions of the day do their sunlit dirty work on any shreds of integrity. John was up early because he was destined to be a savage soldier, but was born in the wrong age. Getting up early pleased his masochistic puritanism, gave him status at work, and helped him avoid the emotional quicksand he felt his family was always trying to envelop him in. Except for Robert, of course, that surface paladin of noble appearance. Shane was up early because he wanted to talk to his father. He was 16. "Morning, Dad," he said, moving slowly into the bright kitchen. His father turned from the coffee maker in surprise.
"The hell are you doing up?" he demanded, then narrowed his eyes. "You've been to bed, right?"
Shane sighed. "I'm in my PJs, Dad."
"Well, I don't know," said John. "Do you do coffee?"
"No, thanks." Shane sat heavily at the breakfast table next to the dying ferns and vines that Jean forbade anyone else to water. The awkward pause commenced, a pause that Shane interpreted as critical and his father experienced as intrusive.
"You want something?"
"Yeah. You got a couple minutes?"
"Couple of minutes. We're not in a trailer park, for God's sake."
"Okay." Shane took a deep breath and pushed his hair back from his forehead. "So I'm... university is coming up, right? And I know you don't really like the art stuff, but that's my thing, Dad. My calling." "It's goofy, I know. It's what I do, and it's what needs to be done. You find cool things in numbers, in business, I guess. I find cool things in lines and colors and like a whole visual. And I'm good at it, Dad. And I don't just doodle. What do you say?" Shane swallowed, his cheeks red.
"Scribbling."
"But it's not that. I get real interest. Mr. Shaw says I'm really good. I had a crowd at the art fair like ooing and aahing. Yeah, it's a crappy art fair, but if I'm the best in school, I might be the best somewhere else."
John scowled. "Don't use up your few minutes on this kind of rambling, Shane. Have some respect for my time."
I want to." Shane shook his head rapidly. "No, you're right. Listen, I'm going to art school." John nodded slowly.
"And?"
Shane blinked. "And it's not free."
"And?"
"Well, like, you make too much money for me to get a scholarship, right? And I don't have enough savings to pay for it all. I mean, it's like tuition, room and board, unless I want to live on the TTC. Actually, you can't even get there from here, Dad." Shane was suddenly emotional. It's the suburbs. Of course, you know, but I need to be downtown, right?"
John sat down slowly, setting his coffee next to a coaster depicting dancing ducks.
Somewhere upstairs, Jean started having a nightmare.
"Your
point, he said slowly. Shane frowned in confusion. His mouth was dry. His heart pounded. I need... Dad! John laughed grimly.
My God, he murmured, a half-smile twisting his lips. You want to be an artist, like every other idiot and his dog. Okay, that's being the ultimate entrepreneur.
He sighed.
You have to sell yourself, son. Do you know that? Do you? You have to pound the pavement, holding your heart in your hand, and beg people to buy your art, to let you even show it. Think my company was just handed to me? No, I hustled like a son of a bitch. I worked it out once. I spent 82% of my time begging people, companies, to be my clients. I was 28 years old, for Christ's sake. Who cared about me? Some clients from my old boss, sure, but then he came at me with lawyers, and I stood alone. Who believed in me? Just me. Not even your mother.
John's mouth was a bitter, creased line.
And I had to make people believe in me. No one can judge you, at least at first. They only judge how you judge yourself.
His eyes darkened.
And I didn't sit in my PJs across from an investor and say,
he imitated his son, I need, could you maybe,
Jesus. I might want to fund this art stuff, but...
John sighed, obviously fighting for self-control. Like when Robert had that paper route.
He hustled, remember? I'm not saying he's some golden boy, but he gets it. Up and down the street, getting people to subscribe. He doubled that route in, what, 2 months? So if he wants to go into business, be a lawyer, good for him. I'm all in. Have you ever tried to sell your art, Shane? You go to these, what, Renaissance festivals? Are there any artists there? People at the farmers market sell their wares, right? There's got to be some way to monetize this stuff. I don't know, it's not my field. But you want to do this for a job, right?
John rubbed his fingers together.
For money, for an income. How are you going to do that? Years from now, after art school, why would I fund someone or anything who can't get off their ass and get behind what they make?
Shane's lower lip was trembling. It's not a paper route, Dad. John pointed a finger at Shane's face.
Don't be obtuse. You know what I'm talking about. Like, if you wanted to be a rapper, right? That LL Cool J, I was reading about him. 16 years old. He didn't just record his crap in his room. He paid to get his records made. Then he drove everywhere to every club and DJ, begging them to play his music, I guess. Took years of persistent effort. It's not about making art, kid. It's about selling art. You can make it, sure. Can you sell it? Or is it just a hobby? Are you a dedicated singer? Or is it just karaoke? I'm not funding a hobby, son.
Well, but... John waved a hand.
Go on, say it. Let's have it out.
Did you make a lot of money as an accountant or an entrepreneur before? For your father paid for your school?
Go on.
Shane shivered. Sorry, I'm not emotional. I'm just cold. You got funded, and then you proved yourself. That's all I'm asking for.
John laughed harshly. Yeah, my dad was useless. Yeah, he paid a bit. But look, Shane, you don't... Accountants don't need to prove themselves as accountants as teenagers, except for not dating. Accountants, who the hell wants to be an accountant? Everyone needs one. No one wants to be one, so the market solves itself. Yeah, I had to sell myself later on, but I got a job out of university because I got great marks and I was eager. And even then, man, it was a recession. I had to pound some serious pavement and ended up getting my first job by fluke because, you'll find this funny, I bet, because one of the hiring managers was a customer of mine from back in the bygone days when I used to deliver newspapers, and he remembered me, the old bastard. Paper always on time, rain or shine, so he hired me. And when I went solo, 99% of people didn't want to give me the time of day. Being an artist is being an entrepreneur. The arts, yeah, you've got it. I think, I guess, I like some of it, but hustling? Walking over broken glass to get your stuff out into the world?
John leaned forward. Shane suddenly realized that his father had not brushed his teeth, and the fetid coffee-laced morning breath gave him sudden nausea. He imagined scraps of zebra hanging from his father's yellow-rimmed teeth.
John said, I don't see it in you, son.
He shrugged. Sorry, not trying to be harsh, just real, honest. You want to take the road less traveled? You better have a good map and an endless will.
How much did you have to pay Dad for university?
John leaned back and whistled.
$500 a year.
And you got loans? Grants?
Grants, said John promptly. A grant, and I paid $150 a month for room and board. I lived in a frat house at first, then off campus. Off campus was about $175, $88 each for me and Rich. I could get by on about $400 a month all in.
And you worked summers?
Yeah, of course. Waitering, then temping. I made good cash, more than enough to pay for school.
And I want to work, but Dad, do you know how much tuition is?
No.
Like $2,500.
John's eyes widened.
Per semester?
No, that's for the year. And renting a room in Toronto?
No idea.
Like $300. Not high-end, just a step above mold and druggy roommates. I've done the math. I know you like the numbers. It's over $10,000 a year. $7,500 living costs, $2,500 tuition, $500 additional fees.
So a four-year degree.
Yeah, I know. Over $40,000. Yours was $7,000 a year, $28,000 in total. It's 70% more. But wages haven't gone up that much since you were younger, Dad. You know, wages have stagnated, so it's like way more for me.
Over 40,000,
murmured John.
Jesus H, that's more than a whole house in Toronto.
Yeah, way back in the day. I mean, you knew about college for me, Dad. You're the big accountant. Don't you have a college fund saved up for me? What are those tax-free things?
RESPs, said John distantly.
And you got paid like a dollar an hour in the 60s?
More when you were temping, of course.
$2?
Yeah, I got that. John's eyes were distant, processing.
Wow. So 60 hours paid for your tuition, 18 for rent and food at the frat.
Shane's eyes were wet.
And you're too rich for me to get grants. I can't do it, Dad. You could. It's a different world.
Yeah. Okay. I'll have to run those numbers, but...
Jesus. I'm out of the loop. Sorry.
John cleared his throat, a vulnerable look flashing across his face.
But... Okay. You're right. It's a different world. Okay. But... So... You have to adapt to that, right?
Money meant more back then, but that means you can't screw around. You get it?
Dad, cried Shane. I'm not trying to screw around. It's my dream.
Yeah, but it's my funding.
The vulnerability vanished. The stern lines reappeared.
So things are different. So you have to be different.
But you keep voting for...
What? What?
Well, you keep voting for... More and more stuff, right? You always told me, us, about the national debt.
Dad, what the hell does that have to do with anything?
The national debt,
murmured Shane miserably.
More and more. Welfare, healthcare, migrants, foreign aid, more and more dilutes the money, right? You remember that talk about counterfeiting?
Bad for art, bad for money, you said. That's just... Economics,
muttered John with a guilty flash of boomer regret.
That's what I inherit, said Shane.
You're blaming me? For the Liberals?
Demanded John. I can't promote the Conservatives. I'd get no clients. So you have to make compromises, right?
Everyone has to, snaps John.
That doesn't mean every mad dream has to eat up the price of a whole house. I guess... Shane cleared his throat. I guess I'm just asking for my education. You got some money. I mean, Dad, you got grants. You got grants and I get debt. I mean, you support this system that buries me in tens of thousands of dollars of debt just for being born. That's over half a house in your youth.
Stuff that self-pity, said John dangerously. It's repulsive.
Shane shook his head slowly, his cheeks red, his eyes watering. The conversation died in their eyes and ears. Why, he said.
Why what? Demanded John.
Why did you abandon me to Mom? Shane desperately wanted to ask. But that would be... blackmail? No. Far too honest. Far too real. His father's vanity would turn that question back on Shane.
Why did you want to hang out with your mommy all the time?
It was a no-win situation. All Shane could do was hope and pray for an eruption of conscience. None of his hopes or prayers were answered, however, so he embraced nihilism, worked incredibly hard all summer, and sailed into the inevitable dark arms of Regina.